The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
I think it's about time for me to get started. My clock says 10:50. So I'm going to start just by telling you who I am, and then I'm going to ask you who you are by a raise of hands so that I know who I'm speaking to, and if you want to move up and get close to each other, that's a welcome room dynamic. I'm Christine Perrin, and I teach at Messiah College in the English department. My kids were educated classically at Covenant Christian Academy in Harrisburg. I have a 22-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 16-year-old. My husband was the headmaster for a decade in this school, and so I also have written a book for Classical Academic Press called The Art of Poetry. We're at booth 310 if you want to see me later if we don't have time to talk here. And poetry has been, I have relied upon poetry to understand, interpret, and bear my life. So I speak, I think, chiefly that's my ethos, even more than the fact that I'm a teacher of poetry. It has been a source of life for me. And so I have a passion to bring other people into a discipline that many people find obscure and difficult, hard to understand, and are really approach poetry afraid of what they don't know. I'm sympathetic to that in general because as a teacher, I find myself often being afraid of what I don't know. Unlike George Grant today was talking about being humble about what we don't know, probably the opposite of that is not just being proud, but being afraid because we think we should know it. I'm sympathetic to that. But in the area of poetry, one thing that I like to just encourage people to begin with is to not be afraid of what you don't know. Poetry is human. It's yours as a human being. You don't have to be an English major or an English teacher to own it, to possess it. As a human being, you are part of a long tradition of people who have sought to do this and sought in many ways to do it very simply. To often poems begin with very simple impulses. And so it's better to think of poems and poets as people who let us live next to them and who bring us through all of the resources of language into the place where they are, so that we can dwell there with them. How many elementary teachers do we have in the room? Could you raise your hand? Okay. And how about dialectic school? All right. And rhetoric? Okay, good. So we have a mix. And what I say today applies to all of you. And I'll try to put it into concrete perspective for each age category. I'm starting with this painting, and you know the Dutch realists are going to be at the museum here in the city starting Sunday. But I love the attention of the face of this woman. She's looking at a stained glass window, which you don't see too clearly in this picture. There's a sense of scrutiny, of wonder, of attentiveness. There's a kind of concentrated quality, and I think it's a very good representation of what of the poetic imagination and where it begins. poetic knowledge is something that we've been talking about in the movement for a number of years. And poetic knowledge is essentially this idea that there's a whole, that it's not just what we know, but it's how we know, and that knowledge begins in wonder. It begins with admiration, love, even. This is, you know, the one who kind of started this tradition was Aristotle, who said that wonder is the beginning of knowledge. And just see here. Here are some quotes from James Taylor, who wrote Poetic Knowledge, the book Poetic Knowledge, and describes it as the immediate, direct apprehension of reality that inspires wonder and awe. And essentially, his book is the argument that until we know things out of wonder and with wonder, we don't know them, that all knowing begins there. And I think that if I had to summarize the argument that I'm making for you today, it would be that poetry is a very strong way to tutor our perceptions, to tutor our understanding in this direction, because essentially that's what poets have done. They've looked at the world, they've gazed at the world with wonder and with admiration and with love, and they've used all the resources of language to bring us next to them so that we could do it with them. And Aristotle's argument is that we aren't truly learning until we're learning with this disposition. So it's also, you see in anthropology, a view that humankind is a certain kind of being, that you can't just stuff with facts and information, you can't just stuff with content, but that our affect and the disposition with which we receive whatever we know is absolutely essential. This is another quote from James Taylor. He says it was his goal, and he thinks it should be ours, to found a school of this kind requires only the listening heart of perhaps just one courageous poetic soul who has come to see intuitively and positively in an awful delight of wonder, as well as from the heights of reason and deliberate, serious thought, that our land, our homes, the heavens and the earth, and those dear and those distant from us are important, not only in their nature, but have meaning and purpose far beyond the reach of the current means of analysis and measurement. Science sees knowledge as power. Poetic knowledge is admiration, love. And he uses other language to describe this: knowledge by sympathy, knowledge by union, knowledge that operates on the premise that the universal is embedded in particulars, which is another Aristotelian thought, that if you look at the particular world, you will be able to reason outward to the universal. And therefore, it's very important to look at the particulars. It's very important to study them. And just to clarify, he isn't saying here that science is not a valid form of study. He's saying even in science, we begin with the poetic knowledge of science. So we begin gazing and touching and smelling and loving. And we move outward from that position. And so my argument for you today is that poetry is a disposition towards the world, and that it has the power to convert the soul, and that conversion of the soul is as important to the learning experience as anything else. We talked today, referred to the Catechism too, which says that our job is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Another way that you might say that is to dwell, to learn how to dwell in adoration. And the poet has learned to do that, and has brought us alongside him or her, so that we can do it with. Another phrase in this quote that I really loved was the listening heart. And I think I'm probably speaking to an audience that knows the writers Tolkien, Homer, and Dostoevsky. And I would just recall to you the way in which the authors of all those authors in their books is constantly referring to the listening heart. That all of the major characters in those books have a way of listening to their heart in order to know. So this is a concept that's really embedded in the greatest literature. It's embedded in, I think, the anthropology of classical education, and it's also embedded in the disposition of the poet. Okay. I don't have my slides entirely in order, I will confess. Here's one more quote that refers to, again, this business of naming, which is what the poet is doing at a level deeper than putting a label on something. And this is a quote from Alexander Schmemann. To name a thing, in other words, is to bless God for it and in it. In the Bible, to bless God is a way of life. God blessed the world, blessed man, blessed the seventh day, and this means that he filled all that exists with his love and goodness. The only natural reaction of man, to whom God gave this blessed and sanctified world, is to bless God in return, to thank him, to see the world as God sees it, and in this act of gratitude and adoration, to know, name, and possess the world. So again, I'm trying to give you definitions and different facets, different angles of what the poet is doing and why this should matter to us. Because ultimately, the poet's task is the task of the human being. How do we name the world in a way that names its essence? How do we possess the world with our gratitude and adoration? How do we dwell in the world? Because what are we going to be doing for eternity? We're going to be dwelling and adoring. And so there's a sense in which this habit of mind that the poetic disposition cultivates is a habit of mind that is essential to our beings long-term and to those of our students. All right, so what I'd like to do, and of course I don't need to tell you that we're at risk for learning this, right? You're all here at the end of the school year and you're exhausted. You just barely got your grades in. You barely covered the material and finished the book. You feel guilty about what you didn't get done. You're here because you want to figure out how to do it better. And you've got this content that you have to communicate in order for your kids to move on, your students to move on to the next level. So very conscious of this. And I'm conscious that especially when you're dealing with mathematics and science, that's different sometimes than in the humanities. And there's this content that's got to be covered. So I think that not only because of our vocations, but also because of the context of the world that we live in, this brain-driven, appetite-driven, mind-only disposition is one that we are particularly susceptible to. So I want to start by, I know I gave you a whole checklist of what poems do, and I want to start illustrating that to you rather than waiting to the very end to get to the poems and the fun part. I want to do it alongside with these virtues that I'm going to try to name. Okay. So let's look at how this functions. This is a poem that if we had time, see, I'm betraying my own principles. We would all stand up and memorize this together, and that's what I do with students. I have stand up and memorize poems together with hand motions. And this is really valuable because it shows you, first of all, just how physical a poem is and how embodied it is, which is one of the virtues of this kind of knowledge, of poetic knowledge. It's physical. It uses your senses. It uses your body. A noiseless patient spider. A noiseless patient spider, I marked where on a little promontory it stood isolated. Marked how to explore the vacant, vast surrounding. It launched forth, filament, 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 out of itself, ever unreeling them, ever tirelessly speeding them. And you, O my soul, where you stand, surrounded, detached, in measureless oceans of space, ceaselessly musing, venturing, throwing, seeking the spheres to connect them, till the bridge you will need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, O my soul. So let's just start with this idea of the particular embedded in the universal. How would you describe that process that's happening in this poem? What's the particular and what's the universal? What's the particular? What are we looking at? What's happening here? I'm asking. Yeah, a spider doing what? Okay. And one of the virtues of poetry, right, is that it doesn't stand up to summary. Its weight is a lot heavier than its summary. So what do we get here from the poem, especially the first stanza, that the summary can't quite accurately convey? What do we understand about the process of web making because of the language, the syntax, the words, the sounds, the way the lines break? What's it telling us? Any observations about that? Okay, great. Yep, we've got ing, right? Ing, ing. We've got ever, ever. We've got filament being repeated, which creates a sense of motion because those filaments are those webs being shot out. Notice I'm making a Spider-Man motion. I didn't mean to do that. So we've got motion. So in other words, this effort of web making is an effort, right? Are there other things that construct that sense of effort for us? Just word choices, perhaps? Okay. So exploring is not an activity that begins and ends very quickly, right? It involves a process. What else?
A silent.
Yes. I think that's one of the curious aspects, and you got that from the title and the first line, that one of the curious aspects of what this poem is emphasizing. When I teach this to students, and I've taught it to students of all ages, fourth grade, I remember my favorite answer about this poem. I said, how does the speaker feel about this about this process? And a student, everybody's quiet, and then someone raised their hand, and he said, it's kind of like when you're lost and you like it. Perfect tone, right? This thing that noiselessness and activity together suggests in some ways a lack of despair, the noiselessness, right? Right now it's just the noiselessness of a spider, and spiders are noiseless, but soon it gets attached to the soul. And so there's this sense of constancy, constant movement, constant working, but the silence of it as well. What else? Yes, the enormity really comes home to us. Every space is every edge is a promontory for a spider, and all space is vast. Anything else about the feel of it? Lewis said this beautiful thing about a story. How you feel about it is part of what it's teaching you. That's very true of poetry and of this poem in particular. How you feel about the poem is part of what it's teaching you. And that's part of what we're saying with poetic knowledge. How you feel about a subject is part of what it's teaching you. And poets can teach you that best because it is not a poem without that element. I saw a hand back there. Yes, I think you're right. I think one of the things that creates that, and of course we're not assuming that Walt Whitman said, let's find some long vowel sounds. No, that's usually not how poems are made, but it behooves us as learners to ask ourselves, what does that to us? Certainly it's the use of the word isolated, it's the use of vacant and vast, but then also the way in which the language works upon us. Vacant, vast, promontory, isolated. So there's this sense of openness in the sounds that creates the space at the same time that it's talking about it. Well, let's move on to the application. So this is the particular. And what is the universal that the particular is showing us, is illuminating for us? And notice it's illuminating it for us with admiration. Inherent in our understanding of whatever this spider is demonstrating for us is the admiration of the speaker, is this wonder of the speaker. It's just part of what we're being told. So what is the universal that the spider reminds the speaker of? It's soul-making activity. It's world-making activity, right? We all make our own web in the world. You, oh my soul, where you stand. And do you see how that's perfectly parallel to the first stanza? Each one has five lines. A noiseless patient spider. And you, oh my soul, where you stand. There's this parallelism between the two. You too, soul, and here that notion of being alone in the wide world is extended in the second stanza, surrounded, detached in measureless oceans of space. Notice, again, that space has been particularized for the soul, surrounded by oceans, surrounded by not just literal oceans, but then oceans of space. And again, the sense of movement. What does the soul do in the world? It muses, it ventures, it throws, it seeks. It's trying to make connections between these spheres in the universe. Do you see how that extends the word explore? And then I won't talk about the end yet. We'll save that for last because it's the best part. But what other choices on the part of the poem and the language of the poem and even the punctuation of the poem give you the sensation of what the speaker is talking about, of what the speaker is naming, because this is a naming that's going on. Something very hard to talk about, the soul's activity in the world, is being named and being brought down to scale, being brought down to human scale. So what do we know about that activity in the world on the basis of the language choices and the syntax choices of the poet? Yeah. So we're talking about this cosmic activity, but it's brought close by the word choice. And I would say as well that that's the whole service of the first stanza. Because if you can look at a spider and you can look what it's doing with a web and you can see how hard it is and you can think about yourself walking through the woods and knocking down those webs and how discouraging it would be if you were the spider and you had to build it all again the next day. But that picture, that small particular, encapsulates the universal, the cosmic. Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. So the "Oh, my soul" gives a reverence to this activity. In other words, this isn't a despairing activity necessarily, which I'm tempted to think because of my disposition when I read this poem. It's funny how the poem can be a mirror for you. Virginia Woolf said, read the same Shakespeare play every year and write down some notes and you get your biography. But the same thing happens on the individual level, right? You read a poem and you read it one way and someone else reads it another way and you think, that says a lot about me. But I think you make a very good point. There's a kind of reverence for this activity. There's almost a holy delight in the fact that we get to make a web of meaning in the world. We get to construct a world out of our connections, out of our personhood. And that is something that creates the tone. Words like that, attention like that creates the tone. And the tone tells us, what are we to make of this? And again, I would just go back to the larger point that I'm making. That is that poetic knowledge is about love and admiration and wonder. And about whatever we learn being in contextualized in that with that disposition in order to truly learn it. That's Aristotle. Later, Augustine came and talked about the argument by desire, that essentially in order to make something our own, we have to love it, we have to desire it. It's not enough just to know it, just to have the facts and information. Frankly, it's not enough to just have a worldview. There's a disposition. There's a way that we hold it. There's an awe and reverence and wonder to the way we hold it. And then secondarily, this notion that in the particular is embedded the universal. And again, the poet is always demonstrating that for us. Demonstrating it with an economy of language, demonstrating it, as you're all pointing out so beautifully, we learn things about the depth of this process and of what this means and of how it breaks our heart, just from the language that the poet chooses, just from the fact that there is no period until the end of this stanza. That alone tells us something about what we're up against. And for myself, you know, looking at a poem this way creates a kind of attention. And this is how I learned to do this. I did it with other people in school. I did it next to other people. So there's the poet doing it. There's the teacher doing it with the student. And again, I'm going to get to this at the end, but I just want to say now, you don't have to be smart about poetry to do this. Look at how much intelligence there is in the room and how I, who know this poem for years and years, I've got it. I say it in my sleep, but you're teaching me things about it today. Because of your humanity, and your students will do the same thing. If you open it up and you begin to teach them slowly, you don't have to be afraid of what you don't know, because remarkable things will come to the surface because of their intelligence about language and about the imagination and because of their attention. I would say as well that for me, this is this importance of finding a language that's adequate to our experience, that is essential for our lives. That if we don't find a language that not only names, but explores and gives us the sense of a felt experience, that we're impoverished from that. And I'll give you examples, but I am consoled by this language and this imagery. I feel a sense of companionship with fellow human beings. It enlarges my sense of empathy. It enlarges my sense that we're all on this journey. We're all doing this hard thing, and this is what we're doing. So we get to the best part, right? This moment of arrival, and what do you notice about it? Till the bridge you will need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere, oh my soul. What do you make of those image choices for arrival, for security, for stability, for making the web? We've got a ductile anchor. Well, we've got a bridge, okay, to get from one place to the other. We've got a ductile anchor, and ductile means bendable, right, movable. So we're not talking about iron here. And we've got a thread, a hand in the back. Very, yes, tenuous, fragile, minimal. Yeah. It's. How do you know that? Uh-huh. Yes. Because of the imagery and because of the language, till. Yes. Till. Until that time, until that moment at which. Now, what kind of assurance does that give us? Absolutely. And he makes more webs, you're right, based on the essence of the world as well as the essence of his task. But also because things fall apart, things get torn down. So as assuring as that language of this will happen is, there's also the beautiful balance and kind of acknowledgement of how hard it is and how tenuous it is and how fragile it is. I would argue that that's another sort of quality of poems, is that, you know, statements can reduce things, and poems keep things as complex as they are. The Chestertonian idea that, you know, you take the two truths next to each other that seem to contradict each other, but you take them both because that's what reality is. And most often that's what poems do well, too, is keep those things in tension. All right, I'm going to move on. I also just want to point out to you that whenever you read a poem, you want to be trying to figure out what the tone is, what the disposition of the author and the speaker towards the subject are. Because you could really get all the parts right, and if you weren't able to synthesize those parts, you might not know what the disposition was. And again, just that emphasis in the poetic, in poetic knowledge on the disposition. All right, let me go back to that quote on naming that I have for you. No, actually, I'm going to go to Robert Frost. It's the problem with rearranging your. So here's another favorite of all of ours, and I would say you probably, how many of you know this by heart already? Great, you can say it with me. Let's say it together, okay? Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake. Ah, you don't know it as well as you thought you did, huh? To ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. There's so much that we could say about this poem, and I am notorious for getting stuck. I like to dwell. I am definitely Mary. I can hardly get through a presentation because I just want to stay here and build a tent and dwell together. But one thing that I would like to point out about what Frost is doing here is giving us, again, a language adequate to experience. And I would ask you, what experience do you think Frost is naming? And where is he naming that experience? this is an experience that we all have. Most of us have it every day. Some of you are Stoics, and you may forget about this experience, but most of us, we're not. So we know this experience intimately from the inside out. What's the experience? Yes, beautifully put. Being torn between duty and pleasure or contemplation. Skole. So what language does Frost use to describe the resolution of that tension? The tension is the woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have a calendar that I have to stick to. No. I have promises to keep. What happens with that language to the poem and to the experience? Yes, commitment. And what happens when you call that commitment a promise that you want to keep? So there's duty in it, but there's, in addition to duty, nobility. There's also desire, right? This is how I want to live. I was with a student once who had taken a poetry class with me, and we were talking about life, and she offhandedly said something about being true to herself, and she kind of laughed nervously because she felt uncomfortable using that language of cliche. And I said, Allison, what would it take for you to be able to say that and not laugh? Because that's a really good thing that you want to do. This is a person who had been sexually abused, who had had a very difficult life, and so her saying this was an enormous, great arrival. But she couldn't say it without being ironic. And she said, I don't know. I said, well, how about promises to keep, the language of promises to keep? And she said, yeah, I think that would do it. Frost is employing all of the resources of language. He's employing all the music that poetry can do. After he wrote this poem, he sat down, he wrote this in one sitting of about an hour. And after he said it, this is my greatest claim on posterity. I am likely to be remembered for this poem. And guess what? He is. Because of its musical precision, right? So we have listened to, of course, we've got the iambs, the four iambs in every line, drawing us in, right? Seducing us into its place. And then we have the rhyme scheme, which is a really interesting one. No, though, here, snow. And then second stanza, queer near lake year. What's happening there? A-A-B-A, and then B-B-C-B. There's an outcast sound in each stanza, and what happens to that outcast sound? It's picked up. So it's either pulling us into the future or pulling us back, whichever way you look at it. And Frost was the great poet of contradictions, of paradox. He really insisted on saying both things. If you look at any of his poems, look at Birches, Directive, he was always saying two things, and he would not privilege one over the other. This one, I think, does privilege promises to keep, but all the structure of the poem embodies what it feels like to be in this position. So I would just point out that there's something named in this poem. There's also something unnamed in this poem. There's something that cannot be named. There's an X factor, and that's something else that poems do that is so important to our the cultivation of our humanity, in the sense that for everything we can say about our lives, and we labor to say, you know, we labor towards being able to say that I have promises to keep. There's a whole cachet of things that we can't quite name. If I tried to name it here, I think I would say something like, this snowy wood is the sum of my desires. That's the unnamed part. And he doesn't tell us that. That would be a terrible line for a poem. This snowy wood is the sum of my desires. That's how we speak in class all day long, right? But what he does tell us is, what he does show us is the sum of his desires, is that longing, that Sehnsucht that Lewis names for us, that Tolkien imbues everything he's written with, that sense that I want something here and I can't leave. And how do we know that the speaker wants something? What in the poem shows us that rather than telling us? That's true. I think that part of the poem goes with the idea of promises. And I'm thinking of that other idea of, I want to stay here and not move because something here is drawing me into itself. And what do you think about the poem achieves that drawing, that magnetic pull? Mm-hmm. Mm. And even that line, to watch his woods fill up with snow, and then the next one later on, of easy wind and downy flake. You feel the way snow feels when it starts filling up, right? The silence, the slow kind of quiet filling of space. Not like an empty library, not like a room that has stone floors so it's echoey, but kind of muffled a little bit. So the poem gives you that experience of wonder, of attentiveness to every smallest detail, of music, right, that draws you deep inside itself. But also of room for the imagination. We know what drives him on. We see what he sees. But somehow, even adding, tallying up, reckoning up all those parts, the poem is heavier and weightier and more beautiful than we can account for. And don't we need that? Because aren't our lives that way? Things don't weigh what the advertisers and the marketers tell us they do, what they say we need. There's something about dwelling in before the subject of our longing, the object of our desire, that we need to experience the kinship of. Let me see if there's anything else. So one of the things I would say is that poetry gives us a language that's adequate to our experience. It also changes our relationship to language in the sense that it's never utilitarian again once you encounter the poem. It's always working upon us, and we become conscious of that exponential capacity of language. It's not just something to communicate. It's not just informational and content-based. The other thing that I would say is about the imagination, and Frost in particular is really good at this because, you know, we're so used to, this is what you have to know for the test. This is what, this is how you summarize that, and that's very important. I think summary is a very important skill. But one of the things that this poet does in particular is gives us room to come to some conclusion that we own as an interpreter. And you are probably familiar with the fact that this poem is widely interpreted as a death wish. And, you know, there's an argument for that. There's an argument that this speaker could be longing for darkness, could be longing for the peace of darkness. And I think it's very important in the literature classroom to let there be room for carefully constructed interpretations that differ with each other. Frost is a great poet to teach that. So is Dickinson. Because because here's the thing. We're not just interpreting what the author intended. My goodness, if Robert Frost stood here, he would say, no, please go beyond me. Please see more than I was thinking in my head at the moment that I was writing it. And that's a metaphysical reality, okay? The metaphysical reality is that things are always more than they seem. Always. I wish we had more time. We don't even... The two views of the world, right? There's the material view and the transcendent view. That all things break down along these lines. Is it just what we see or not? And metaphor itself breaks down along these lines. There's spirit and there's matter. There's the abstract and the concrete. And they're not sundered. They're together. They dwell together. And when you sunder them, there's a problem. So what the poet teaches us is how closely they dwell together, the mystery that's present in them, and the work that it takes to sift and unravel some of what's going on there. And you can teach your students that here's the danger, here's the fear, right? Is it whatever anybody thinks it is? Can people just make it up? And the answer is no. It's your job as the teacher, and you can do this slowly by example. It's your job to show them what it would take to construct one reading or another, okay? And you could say, this could be interpreted this way, or this could be interpreted this way. And if you were interpreting it this way, you would point to this. And if you were interpreting it that way, you would point to this. For instance, I'll give you two quick examples. In this poem, I mentioned that outcast sound, right, in each stanza. You could argue that outcast sound was pulling you on to the next. Or you could argue that it was pulling you on to behind. You could argue about that last stanza, miles to go before I sleep, that was a firm conviction. It was so firm that he said it twice. And miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Or you could argue the opposite. That it was because he was talking himself into it, because he wasn't moving anywhere, which that's what happens with the rhyme scheme, right? It doesn't move anywhere. Look at the rhyme scheme of the last stanza. Deep, keep, sleep, sleep. Okay, if you ask me, that's a rhyme scheme winding down. That's a rhyme scheme of someone who can't move from this place as much as he protesteth otherwise. So do you see what I mean? And Frost gives us room. And there's a way to interpret it intelligently and build a case for either one. And you as a teacher are going to relax if you're allowed to not have one right answer, but to have one answer that you can support, even in the smallest way. And you can teach your students to do that. And you can encourage intelligence in the classroom as opposed to a kind of... aesthetic chaos. You can encourage that careful looking and building. All right, let's move on. I just will say this one quote for you by Alan Shapiro that illustrates what I was just talking about really beautifully. If all art is symbolic of a kind of moral plenitude or fullness of conflicting attitudes and impulses explored and worked through towards some ideal clarity, sorry, I was typing quickly, the act of reading is itself a model of ideal human relations, aspiring toward a perfect attentiveness in which emotional possession and intellectual comprehension, what experience conditions us to see, and what the text insists we see, inform and alter one another. Reading well, in other words, is symbolic loving. And to shorthand that, because I know it's a dense quote, there's a sense in which the text insists on a few things, and our experience conditions us to a few things. And if you don't believe me, you try reading Tolkien with people who aren't Christian. And there are plenty of people like that, and they will not see the depth of Christian realism embedded in that book. What you are conditioned to see by your experiences is a part of the reading experience. What the text is saying is a part of the reading experience. And there's this wrestling that goes on, this battling back and forth. And in classical education and in poetic, when we're pursuing poetic knowledge, that wrestling is absolutely essential on both the personal and the subjective and that which is outside of us, the reality outside of us, and the two coming to blows with each other, coming to a wrestling match with each other. And essentially he's saying this is symbolic of even if our best relationships, who we are and who the other person are, they meet and they engage in this great contest or engagement. All right, moving on. I wanted to just also mention the metaphoric sort of powers of poetry and the reason that you need poetry in your classroom is partly just to develop a shared body of metaphors, a shared body of images that you and language that you and the class can refer to with each other. That is one of the great pleasures of learning. You know, we know this together. Isn't that exciting? We have our own secret language together. We have images that help us understand our lives together. So it's in community, not just as an individual, finding consolation and kinship with the poet. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs, which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. And I'll just, you know, I won't try to do this whole poem right now. It's worth doing. But I'll just say that one of my great pleasures in fall, as we're heading into winter, is this poem. It increases my pleasure of life, of the season. That time of year thou mayest in me behold. Of course, the speaker is saying, I am at the fall going into winter of my life. I am at the end of my life. And you can see that in me, speaking to the beloved, because most poems are spoken to the beloved. And he's saying, it's like that moment when there's just a few yellow leaves shaking on the branch. Right? We all know that moment. And that moment, I mean, part of the beauty of metaphor is that it's reminding us that it's awakening us to our lives so that we see the leaves, we see the empty tree, and we remember we're going to die. And that's why we have fall and winter, because it reminds us of that every year. So there's this sense in which the metaphor is both explaining something abstract, but it's also giving us a concrete experience of things that we need to know in order to live well. It's how our mind works. It's how we experience the world. It happens in, you know, you can't go to a philosophy class or a science class without having metaphors, because there's no way to talk about atoms except by metaphor, even though there's a visual description of atoms now. It's a metaphor. Even the visual is a metaphor. We absolutely cannot speak about most things about anything without metaphor. Even God in the creed, there are metaphors to describe God in the creed. Okay, Christ, of course, is the physical, concrete, incarnational manifestation of God. And so built in, again, to the very fabric of how we were made to think and how the world is this structure. And when you study it in poems, you begin to understand it in the world around you, in addition to all of these other things. So another thing just to say I really love about this poem is the way in which the empty tree branches are being compared to an empty church's rafters, those bare ruined choirs of an empty church. I don't know if you've ever gone into an empty church. And there's something so sad about it, but there's also something so beautiful and haunting about those bare ruined choirs, the rafters as well as the choir loft, where it was once full and alive, and that's leaving. Of course, in this poem, part of the intelligence is that we move from metaphor to metaphor, and as we move, it becomes more and more localized. So we've got the time of year, we've got the day, the twilight of such a day, and then we've got a fire. So there's this intuitional movement. Time is growing short even in the space of the poem. I have just a very little bit of time, and even though there was one more poem that I've been delighting in myself and networking to my experience over years that I wanted to share with you, I'm not going to do that. That was We Grow Accustomed to the Dark by Emily Dickinson. But I wanted to just say a couple things about this in your classroom. Don't be afraid of what you don't know. Simply start by reading a poem aloud to start the day. That, if that's all you do, you've done a lot. Memorize a poem together as a class, perhaps regularly, but even if you do one a year, take one of these poems from today and memorize it with your class next year. And things will happen. I guarantee it's magical. There's no stopping this if you give it even the smallest bit of time. Start talking slowly about the elements of the poem. And most poetry books, including the one that I wrote, Art of Poetry, breaks it down and describes the elements, such as images, such as metaphors, such as stanza, line. Begin to build a library of books and a library of references in your classroom. So again, assimilate the language and the images of the poem and the metaphors of the poem to speak to each other. You know, recently I was trying to explain to my son why I wasn't sure he should go to the beach with a friend. And he's like, "Don't you trust me?" We were talking about, like, how do you deal with lust? Anyway, it was a long conversation. And I said, "Noah, it's a Gandalf and Galadriel thing. It's not about you, you know." And instantly he knew exactly what I was talking about, Gandalf and Galadriel. They don't take the ring because they don't think because of their strength, because they're wise. That language, that shared language, do you see how instantly I was able to talk about a world of things simply by two names? And the same thing will happen to you in your classroom when you begin to acquire this language that you can share together. I use this language to understand my life. When I describe to students what's it like after college, I say way leads unto way. You know, you get to one place and the door opens from there. It doesn't open at the beginning. These particulars really they're useful. It's not just that they're beautiful and they inspire you. They do. But they actually describe things that are hard to describe. And so I would encourage you to build that together. Speak of history with these things. Speak of philosophy. Speak of science. It will aid all of the subjects that you're studying and teaching. And it will aid your classroom community. So then start to build a library of books, and I have some recommendations where your students get to start choosing the read aloud poems at the beginning of the day. And here are some suggestions. I will put this up on my blog so that you can reference it later. It's just Art of Poetry Online. And since I only have 2 minutes left, I'm going to then tell you a couple things to do with your school. We've done this in our school, and it's been terrific. The response is just from normal kids. These are not poetry-loving, you know, gurus. These are normal kids. And a couple of things that we do, we have a poetry contest every year where students are required in the literature classroom to memorize poems and recite them in a performative way before the class, and then three are chosen from the class and they recite them before the school, and then three are chosen for cash prizes, and you can get someone to sponsor that outside of the school. And then in the upper school, that's 7th through 9th grade, in the upper school, 10th through 12th, there's one chosen for poetry out loud. And I would strongly encourage you. It's one of the greatest things that the National Endowment for Humanities ever came up with Dana Gioia. I would strongly encourage you to look that up and do it in your school. There's government funding for it. It's just remarkable what happens when students begin to see other students knowing these poems and expressing these poems the way they do. And that's all online. So just Google poetry out loud. we have poetry liturgies, and I'll show you a quick example of what that is in a moment. You could also have an elective where students studied and wrote poems together. Our school has done poetry notebooks where we have students collect favorites in different categories. So again, it's kind of like a commonplace book that's selected by appetite, by desire, by delight, and you could share it with each other and use those as the basis for the read-alouds in the morning. And then as well, sometimes schools have done that school-wide, where there's a poem that they're all sharing, you know, every week or every month or every year. I know some schools that choose two poets a year throughout each grade, and they just do a deep dive into those two poets, and the students really know them afterwards. Do not underestimate the power and strength of giving your students familiarity with a body of work of a poet. That's a great pleasure to recognize that. All right, in my remaining 30 seconds, I am going to show you what a poetry liturgy is. It is a remarkable thing that we came up with where students, I don't think I can talk and explain and show you at the same time, where students, for a particular occasion, whether it's Thanksgiving, civic holiday, a civic celebration, or part of the calendar year of the church, such as ordinary time, such as Good Friday or Maundy Thursday, we collect poems that are relevant to the subject. In the literature classroom, they spend time in pairs writing a meditative response to the poems. And then we have an event, we call it a poetry liturgy simply because we haven't come up with a name that's better than that, but we gather as a school and read the poem, read the meditation, intersperse it with pictures, sometimes music, sometimes live music, and it becomes a meditative event on the subject that we have chosen, whereby these students in a particular classroom are guiding us all more deeply into that event. And I will tell you something, there are a couple things that happen. First of all, people come out of it ecstatic. They like it. They really like it. These are, again, you're saying, not my kids, try it. They do, even young children. Secondly, they learn that we don't study literature just to tear it apart in the literature classroom. Literature is here to help us move more deeply, think more deeply, dwell more deeply together. And you will experience the way in which when you dwell with attention together over something that students have given you as a gift to lead you in, not a paper, but to lead you into a reality, your experience builds on itself. You come to a place of attentiveness. You come to a place of understanding and even of delight that you could not have gotten to by yourself. So I've got to stop now. If you'd like to talk to me further or ask me questions, please stay or come see me in the Classical Academic Press booth. Thank you.